Thank you, Johnny. That is good to hear stories and yeah, just what's going on in your life. Really appreciated that. And it's good to see a lot of people here and some new faces, people we haven't seen in a while. So welcome. I feel a bit unprepared this morning. We had kind of a crazy weekend. But I guess it all worked out, so thank you, Johnny, for taking up some time for me. I usually end up with about 6 to 8 pages of notes, and I'm about 4.5, so it should be good. We're in the middle of a kind of a series I called The Story, and it's kind of looking at the big picture story of how everything that God did in history is pointing forward to Jesus, and how it all leads up to that that climax. And right now we're in the middle of Exodus, looking at the children of Israel coming out of Egypt on their way to Canaan. And we've been kind of camping out at Mount Sinai for a while here, and sorry for the pun, that was intended, where God renews his covenant with the Israelites and gives them the Ten Commandments along with a lot of other laws and guidelines. And last time we looked at the crazy ordeal with the golden calf, and kind of spent most of the time looking at how Aaron handled that, and how that's an example of what not to do in leadership. Kind of a different perspective than what I've looked at that before. And I had originally planned to kind of pack up and move out of Sinai after that, because we have spent a lot of time there, but what happens next at Mount Sinai, it doesn't exactly give you the warm fuzzies, which is part of why I didn't want to stay there. It's a really difficult account or story of what happens next there. But I guess after looking at it a bit more, I kind of decided that what happens after Moses comes down from the mountain is pretty important to the big story. And if we don't look at that, we're missing part of what God intends us to understand from that, I think. So even though it's not fun and it's not pretty, I think we have to look at it. We have to understand what went on there. I'm just going to do a little bit of a recap of chapter 32, what we looked at last time. So if you want to turn to Exodus 32, I'm not going to read the whole chapter again, but I'll just do a bit of a recap. So God calls Moses up to the mountain, up on the mountain, and he's up there for 40 days and nights. And the people get bored and come to Aaron, and they're like, you know, we don't have a clue what happened to this Moses guy. And I think by extension, they're thinking, so his God is probably kind of done with us too, Moses God. They ask Moses to make them a new god that can lead them out of this place and that they can worship. And, you know, they're thinking Moses is kind of a goner. He's not coming back. We need something else. So Aaron's like, well, give me all your gold. And we looked at this last time. The people are fine with that. And there's some scholars that think that he was probably trying to push them off. He didn't actually expect them to give him their gold, because that was the most valuable thing they had. And if you remember what happened when they left Egypt, they got a bunch of that from the Egyptians when they left. So there was probably a substantial amount of it that they had, and it would have been their most valuable possession. So Aaron's like, well, give me your gold, and they're just like, sure, here you go. And so at that point, he has to do something with it. He can't just put an end to the whole thing there. So he melts it down, turns it into this calf, which probably translated more of a bull. If you look at what the popular gods would have been, that they would have been kind of modeling this on. He makes this calf, or this bull, this god, and the people love it. I mean, they set it up right away and start dancing around it and worshiping it. And I have to think that Aaron was a little flattered by that, This is something that he made, and so he's kind of flattered by this, the fact that the people like this so much. And so instead of putting an end to it right there, he kind of lets it go on. But then, to maybe kind of appease his conscience or whatever, he says that the next day they would set up, or that he would set up a, a sacrifice, or anyway, they would have a meeting where they would worship God again, and trying to turn this thing back toward worshiping the true God instead of this calf. Well, we know what happens next. Instead of having a feast day to the Lord, like Aaron proposes, it turns into just more worship of this idol and a complete devolving into just wickedness, a giant party. Anyway, so Moses comes back down from the mountain, and he gives Aaron an earful pretty quickly. And Aaron's like, just calm down. You know how these people are. They're awful and wicked, and there's nothing I could do about it. So he pushes the blame back onto the people. He doesn't take any responsibility for himself. And to top it off, he ends with, the people gave me their gold. I threw it in the fire, and out jumps this calf. Just obviously not true, and the paraphrase is mine, so forgive me for that. But clearly, not an example of a great leader. So that brings us to the part that we're going to look at for most of our time this morning. Actually, the first thing I wanted to look at is verse 20. I know we read this last time, but we didn't really dig into what he was saying here. So if you want to turn to verse 20 of chapter 32. Actually, I'm going to start at verse 19 because it gives a little context here. So I'm going to read 19 and 20. It says, as soon as he came near the camp, talking about Moses, and saw the calf and the dancing, Moses' anger burned hot, and he threw the tablets out of his hands and broke them at the foot of the mountain. He took the calf that they had made and burned it with fire and ground it to powder and scattered it on the water and made the people of Israel drink it. Now, what I found really interesting about this a detail that I'd never caught before, what's the first thing that Moses does when he comes off the mountain? And it's a little bit confusing as to what the actual order of events are here, but it seems like the first thing he does is just completely destroys this idol that they had set up. And the part that I guess the detail that I'd missed, instead of taking this gold and melting it back down into maybe something that they could use for bowls in the temple later, well, the tabernacle first, or maybe, turning it back into earrings or bracelets or something, instead of doing that, he just completely destroys it, turns it into powder. But then it goes further than that. He spreads it on the water and makes the people drink it. This gets a little disgusting, but think about what happens when somebody drinks something. How does that end up? It ends up in an outhouse somewhere, right? So this idol that they'd set up, their most valuable possession, the gold that they had taken out of Egypt, turns into the most disgusting thing you can imagine. And I think that's a symbol, like that wasn't by accident. I think God was making a point with that this is what happens to the gods that you set up in place of me. This is what I do to them. And we see this pattern. It looks a lot like what God did to the Egyptian gods. Just completely annihilates them through the plagues. And to understand that, you have to kind of look at exactly what gods were being taken down in the plagues. But kind of a continuation of that pattern. When God is replaced by a fake God or a false God, God does not let that thing last long, at least not in the term of history. Sometimes to us it looks like the gods that are being set up are continuing to stay there, and I won't necessarily go into examples now, but in the term of history, God does not let those things stand for very long. And it's not just a takedown, it's a complete and utter destruction of those gods. And that's what happens here. Maybe we forget, you know, just how jealous God is of our worship, and how seriously he takes idolatry. I think because we have Jesus as our mediator, a lot of the seriousness of that is lost on us. And we'll get into a little bit more of that later, but we don't immediately face the consequences of our sin because of what Jesus did for us. And so maybe that leads us sometimes to forget just how serious it is. Anyway, but that doesn't make God any less worthy of our worship or less jealous of it. And I think we need to remember that. So anyway, moving on to verse 25 through the end of the chapter, I'm just going to read, actually I'll read down through 29. So 25 to 29. And this is what happens after Moses comes out off the mountain. It says, "When Moses saw that the people had broken loose, for Aaron had let them break loose to the derision of their enemies, then Moses stood in the gate of the camp and said, 'Who is on the Lord's side? Come to me.' And all the sons of Levi gathered around him, and he said to them, 'Thus says the Lord God of Israel, put your sword on your side, each of you, and go to and fro from gate to gate throughout the camp, and each of you kill his brother and his companion and his neighbor.' And the sons of Levi did according to the word of Moses, and that day about 3,000 men of the people fell. And Moses said, 'Today you have been ordained for the service of the Lord, each one at the cost of his son and of his brother, so that he might bestow a blessing upon you this day.'" And like I mentioned at the beginning, I really didn't want to dig into this because this part of the story is, it's not how we want this account to end, is it? I think I would rather see God send a lightning bolt and just blow up the calf, and then all the people fall down and worship him and repent, and maybe a voice from heaven just comes and reminds the people that, you know, I am your God and I still love you and I have a plan for you and I'm going to make a great nation out of you and I still love you even though you did this. You know, that's how we would like this story to end. But that's not how it ends. And this isn't really the God we like to read about, is it? It's not who we want to portray our God as being. You know, instead we have to kind of wrestle with this picture, I guess, this awful picture. And maybe it doesn't hit us as hard as it should, but imagine what it would be like to have your fellow brothers, friends, whatever, come around and just start killing people among you. And then imagine that image sticking with you for the rest of your life. This is not just some account that we read about in the distant past. It's if the Bible is true and this actually happened, this has some pretty huge effects on the people that it happened to. And where's the God of love and forgiveness in all of that? And why did God make the ones who wanted to stand for him? I mean, they had a choice there to continue on with what the people were doing or to come over and stand with Moses. Why did he have them be the ones that had to do this awful thing? You know, why didn't he reward them in some other way? And these are not just kind of throwaway questions to fill time in a sermon. These are serious questions that have challenged everyone that's read the Old Testament, I think, seriously. Maybe if you haven't wrestled with this yet, you probably will at some point. Why is there a God like this in the Old Testament and yet a God of love and forgiveness that we know? And how do you reconcile those two? And these are questions that are used by people who hate God to bring doubt to people that love God. It's usually one of the first things that comes up when you dig into, you know, the whole debate of is God good or is there a God, or it's a serious question, serious questions. And I think that's part of why we need to look at it. I'm just going to say right up front, it's too big of a subject or too deep for me to really bring full answers to. And so for that, I guess for that reason, I'm going to look specifically at this event and not necessarily how do you answer the question of who is God in the Old Testament and how does that reconcile with, you know, with the New Testament. I'm not necessarily going to get into that. I'm going to look specifically at this account and try to help us understand, I guess maybe why God did what he did there, and I guess go from there. Anyway, I guess I would like to preface all that by saying that I don't believe God needs defending. And I think that's an important point when we come at this. There's kind of a, and I was probably maybe even a little more wrapped up into it than I should have been. There was kind of a movement for a while, maybe it's still going on, I don't know, but this idea that apologetics can answer all the questions about God. And apologetics in the sense of like logic and reason can help us understand who God is, what he's doing, why he did what he did. If we have all the right arguments, then we can explain all of that away. All the hard things. I'm not saying explain God away, but explain all the questions that we have or that other people may have about God. We can explain all that away if we use the right arguments through logic and reason. And I think there is definitely a place for apologetics. I have learned an incredible amount from people who kind of take that approach. People like, I was going to say Ravi Zacharias, but I think there's a lot of baggage with him now, so maybe we should steer clear of that. But just, you know, that mindset of God did give us minds for a reason, and we can use that to help us understand things about who he is. And I still very much believe that. We're not just brainless robots that God created to just follow him without using the brains that he gave us. But at the same time, that cannot fully explain God. And so for that reason, I think we have to understand that it's not our place to defend who God is or what he does. It's not our job to have to do that. I'm not saying there isn't a place to help somebody understand things better, but it doesn't fall on us to try to defend God. If God is who he says he is, he doesn't need defending or explaining. It's our place to understand where we fit into his bigger picture. We don't have to fit God into what we think is right or just. Maybe a subtle difference, but I think it's important to understand that. It's maybe one of the reasons why I've had my questions about the God's Not Dead movies. And I wasn't going to go down this rabbit hole, but I'll just mention it. Think about that when you see those types of movies. The idea that we have to defend who God is, I think sometimes leads us to just maybe want to make ourselves look better to people that don't believe the same thing we do, instead of actually making God look good. And again, maybe that's a subtle difference, but I think it's a mindset we have to consider. My place before God is not one of having to defend him. My place before God is one of submission. And if there's things about God I don't understand, it's simply because I don't understand it yet. It's not because he is wrong. And I don't have to come at it from that perspective. Anyway, I'll leave it at that. I guess I say that to say that I don't have this figured out. And I don't want to come across as having the answers or all the answers to this. But going back to the text, if we read the whole context and actually look at kind of the big picture of the story here, it would appear that Moses orders the Levites to do this while the people are still in the middle of this giant party, this orgy that's going on. And we looked at this a little bit last time. This was more than just them dancing around a calf. This had turned into complete debauchery. If you understand the, or kind of dig into the, I guess the Hebrew words that are used to describe it, it's more than just a worship of a god. This turned into a very wicked and perverted thing. And it even says, verse 25, it specifically mentions to the derision of their enemies. And there's a term that's used in there that would indicate that they had actually made themselves naked, which would indicate why it says to the derision of their enemies, which were watching them. So this had become more than just a worship of a god. It had turned into something very dark and evil. And so if we have that understanding, and we understand that this was still going on when Moses comes down, like they're still in the thick of this, it might explain why Moses is like, we have to end this now. And so he uses the most drastic means possible to do that, and just sends the Levites out to start killing the leaders of this thing. And all the scholars that I read seem to think that this wasn't just an indiscriminate killing of whoever, you know, happened to be in the path of these Levites. This was, they knew who they were supposed to kill. And it would have been the leaders of, I guess, the ringleaders of what was going on there. So maybe, I mean, again, it doesn't change the fact that this is an awful punishment. This is a horrible thing that happens here. But it maybe helps us understand that the level of wickedness that they had devolved into, it needed to be stopped immediately for there to be any hope of saving the whole nation. Because God was already ready to just wipe them all out. If you look at his conversation with Moses later, he offers again to just wipe them all out and start over with Moses. So I think Moses understood that this had to end now. Most of the most of the commentaries I read said this wasn't just an indiscriminate killing of everyone. But if you think about what would have happened there, that would have pretty quickly put a damper on this thing. You would have had people scattering in a hurry. And so in terms of bringing judgment, it would have done that, but it also would have ended the sin that was still going on. And that, you know, that maybe gives us a little bit of a context for why God through Moses ordered this. But I think there's still a bigger point here that we have to understand. And I think the big picture point here is that sin always brings death. We have to understand that sin always brings death. And there's no exceptions to that. If we look at the very first sin in Genesis, and you know the story, God gives Adam and Eve the entire garden full of good things, and they can do whatever they want to except don't eat that one tree. And what do? They eat the fruit of that one tree. And the first thing that happens after that is animals have to die to make clothes for them. So death is brought into it. And even though they didn't die immediately, they died in the spiritual sense of being innocent. And then later, will die a natural death, which they wouldn't have if they would have obeyed. They could have stayed in the garden. So we see that pattern started there. And then we have the flood, where every living thing is killed except for the ones in the ark. Because of the massive amount of sin that had come into the world. And then we see animal sacrifice actually starting with Cain and Abel already, which is interesting because if you think about it, the process, I guess, or the ceremony of sacrifices for atonement of sin hadn't really been set up yet. So I'm a little bit, I guess that detail kind of slipped me before. Where did they even know what to do with that or how to do that? But that had already been started back then. There was a bloodshed and sacrifices for sin back then already. And then if we move on through the story of the Israelites and going into Canaan and then living there, We see over and over that when they sinned, you know, a nation would invade them. There'd be tremendous suffering and death. And then when they turned back to God, you know, there would be blessing again. And I think the point is just made over and over, and it's repeated numbers of times in the New Testament as well. The point is very clear that sin always brings death, and in some way, and this is a point that we have to understand, I think, for the rest of the Bible to make sense. If we don't understand that point, that sin always brings death, then I guess the big story of redemption and of what Jesus came to do doesn't make sense either. At least it doesn't have the impact on us that it should. Because if the wages of sin are not death, then why did Jesus come? Was it just to make our lives better? Obviously, that's not the case. I guess we could ask then, but why? Like, why are the wages of sin death? Well, I don't know the mind of God in that. And that's probably a bigger subject than we can tackle today. But I thought through that just a little bit, and I guess if we look at God as who he says he is, being the creator of all things, and the creator of life and light, if that is who he is, and sin is a rebellion against God as the creator, then choosing to rebel against God or sinning is a rejection of light and life, because he is the creator of it. Maybe that's a little bit of an abstract thought, but I think it helped me understand maybe a little bit more why God reinforces that point over and over. If I reject God, I'm rejecting the very author of life, and so I'm rejecting life itself. Because the opposite of God is death and nothingness. And so if I reject the commands of God, I'm rejecting the person of God and God as the creator. And yeah, like I said, rejecting the one who gives life is rejecting life itself. You can't separate life from God if he is who he says he is. And I think, like I mentioned before, we're incredibly blessed to have salvation, where, you know, a sinning against God does not result in immediate physical death because of what Jesus did for us. But I think the principle is still there. It's the same. If I reject the gift of God of salvation, I'm also rejecting life itself, because that is rejection of God's plan to redeem us. And so the same principle applies. Rejecting the gift of salvation is rejecting life itself. Anyway, back to the text. I thought about the Levites a little bit there, and just, again, the account there in Exodus. Why were the Levites chosen to bring the consequences of sin on the people? And then we see that they're promised to become the priests of the temple and the tabernacle going forward. Like, I mean, that's, I guess if I had the choice, I'm not sure that I would want that job. And why them? I mean, you know, they're asked to carry out this awful thing, but then they also become the ones that minister, you know, or administer the sacrifices and all that in the temple. Why are the two connected there? And I had to think about it. The tasks are pretty similar, really. You know, they were called then to be the ones that had to kill those animals and shed all that blood for all those years. And in some ways, what they did here in bringing judgment on the people, you know, the death of those 3,000 in some ways avoided a much more serious consequence on the whole nation. And I think it was kind of a precursor, or maybe a foreshadowing would be the word, of what their job would be going forward and how they would minister in the tabernacle. At the end of verse 29, Moses says that God will bestow a blessing on the Levites because of what they did. And I was like, where's the blessing in having to serve as a priest and killing all those animals? And I don't know. It doesn't seem like a blessing that I would want, I guess. But I think there definitely was some things that came out of that. For one thing, the priests were very well provided for. If you look at all the details of how they were taken care of, their needs were provided for by the people bringing their gifts to the temple. And maybe that's a bigger deal than we think about now, because we don't think too much about where our food's going to come from and all that. But they had kind of job security. Maybe that's a pretty slight detail in the big scheme of things. But that would have been one of the blessings. And then also, they were very well respected as a tribe, and God preserved them through all the nations, or through all the generations, as his kind of chosen tribe out of the people. And I think there is a blessing in that. I mean, a number of the tribes were just lost in history because of what happened in some of the judgments. I'm going to keep moving here. I'm going to read verses 30 through 35 and then kind of wrap it up with that. Verse 30, it says, "The next day Moses said to the people, 'You have sinned a great sin, and now I will go up to the Lord. Perhaps I can make atonement for your sin.' So Moses returned to the Lord and said, 'Alas, this people has sinned a great sin. They have made for themselves gods of gold. But now, if you will forgive their sin, but if not, please blot me out of your book that you have written.' But the Lord said to Moses, 'Whoever has sinned against me, I will blot out of my book. But now go, lead the people to the place about which I have spoken to you. Behold, my angel shall go before you. Nevertheless, in the day when I visit, I will visit their sin upon them.' Then the Lord sent a plague on the people because they made the calf, the one that Aaron made." And this section was a little confusing to me, because I'm not sure if this is in chronological order with the rest of the chapter. And there's actually a lot of debate on this when I started digging into it a little bit. Was this a separate plague from the 3,000 that were killed? Or is that the plague that he's referring to, and this is just kind of a different... It's not necessarily trying to put it in chronological order here. And some scholars think that this account... or that the plague that's mentioned there is referring to the 3,000. But others would say that, no, the plague was a separate thing. That was a judgment on all the people, because they all would have contributed in some way to, you know, providing the gold for the calf. And so there needed to be another punishment for them. I don't know. I guess if you look at all the other accounts where there's plagues, it usually seems to give some kind of a detail, either the number of people that were killed by it, or some details of what the plague was, you know, if it was a disease or... And there's nothing of that there, so I definitely could see the point that this is referring to the 3,000 that were killed. That was the plague. But it is interesting that it's using the word plague and not, you know, something else. Anyway, you're left feeling a little bit empty in this, because where's the redemption? Like we talked about already, where's the, I guess, the silver lining in all of this? And there really isn't one, aside from one little detail, I guess, that kind of hit me. Moses tries to take the place or take the sin for the people. And I think that's a foreshadowing, and he couldn't. Like, God would not allow him to do that because he was not perfect himself. And that's a foreshadowing of what Jesus would do. It's very clear, I think. And it's also interesting to look at the change in Moses. When God first comes to him at the burning bush and asks him to go lead the people out of Egypt, he does not want to do it. You know, he would rather stay in the desert wandering around with his sheep. That's much more comfortable to him than doing what God asks him to do. He doesn't care about his people anymore. But God does something in him through all those hard things that he goes through. He does something in him that changes him to the point where he is willing to sacrifice his life, and his life for all of eternity. I mean, blotting his name out of the book. And I didn't dig into what that book is, because where does that even come up? How did he know there's a book? It's mentioned later in the New Testament, but apparently there was some understanding of that. We would call it the Lamb's Book of Life now. But he had an understanding of that to some degree, and he was willing to just lay his life down completely for the people, and God says, no, we can't do that. And we know now because it had to be a perfect lamb, and Moses was not the sinless man that needed to be the one to take the place. But it does point us, you know, we know the rest of the story, and that's pointing forward to something that can take the place of our sin. There's also one other thing that I guess is a bit of a silver lining, maybe. The Levites were set up as the priests, and there was a system being set up by God to be able to take the sin of the people through sacrifices. And there wasn't that before. And so even though we look at the sacrificial system as kind of the old system, I don't know what we would call that, we have a better one now with what Jesus did for us. But before there was even the sacrificial system, there was nothing. It was simply death after sin. And through this, God is setting up the Levites who can offer those sacrifices as an atonement for the people. And that doesn't change the fact that sin still equals death, but the death could be passed on to the animals going forward. Anyway, so this is all leading up to something greater that's coming. But we don't see that in this story, and so we're left with, what is God doing here? And it's sad. I mean, there's, you know, those people died, and if there was a separate plague, I'm sure there was a lot of suffering and maybe even death from that. But because we know the rest of the story, we're not left hopeless. And I think the point here, like we already looked at, is if sin equals death, there has to be something that can break the power of that sin over our lives. It can't just be something that can cover it. It needs to be something that can break it. And all this death and destruction, I think, is helping us to better understand how huge of a deal Jesus is when he comes and does what he does. And if that sin always brings death, then the fact that Jesus came and broke that grip of sin on us is a complete game changer. And maybe we don't fully, when Easter comes around, we celebrate and we're incredibly grateful, I think, but maybe we don't fully understand just how much we have to be thankful for in that. And the fact that that breaking of the grip of sin is for all of mankind, whereas this sacrificial system that was being set up was only for the Israelites. There still was no hope for the other nations. So what Jesus does, it's what this is all pointing forward to, and it's what Easter is all about. So I guess that's the silver lining. Even though this story doesn't bring that out, we know the bigger picture and can be incredibly grateful for that. So that's what I have. God bless you.